correction piece or an extra bit involving Christoffel symbol. Either one of these pieces alone did not have nice coordinate transformation properties, but when you put them together in that way, what you find is that that object is denser. So that was one of the nice properties of this. Another property is that I forgot to turn on the phone, sorry. So one nice property of the covariate derivative is that it's a tensor. The other is that it gives us the derivative that we have expected when we go to flat space, or alternatively, if I think of being in an inertial frame where I've at least at a point set the metric equal to the flat space metric and killed the first derivatives of the metric. Although here I have to add that I'm thinking about flat space in Cartesian coordinates, because even if I'm in flat space but pick some interesting curvilinear coordinates, i.e. polar coordinates, or e.g. polar coordinates, then there is a non-trivial Christoffel symbol, even though I'm talking about flat space. And in that case, this term you can think of as correcting for the fact that the basis vectors you're using are changing as you move around in the space. Given this result, though, for our ordinary vectors or our contravariant vectors, what we did, or what I did, is I wanted there to be a Leibniz rule or a chain rule. And I also wanted this to act on scalar functions or objects that had no indices. So there, the natural rule is that this is just an ordinary derivative. There aren't any extra indices around, and so there's nothing to be confused about. But if I put those two together, what we could do by thinking about the inner product of a vector and a covector, or a vector and a one form, we came up with a rule for the covariant derivative of a one form, which again has an ordinary derivative piece, and then a Christoffel symbol piece, but the indices and the sign get massaged a little bit. So there is alpha mu s beta. And so the trick that we used here, though, of knowing how the covariant object derivative works on one object and demanding these two properties allows us to bootstrap then up to more general objects beyond vectors. In principle, you know, we can think about tensors with lots of indices, as I've written here. So here I've got n raised in the indices, b lowered indices, and I'm taking a covariant derivative. And this is the rule. And so there's always just the ordinary derivative of all the entries in our tensor. And then for each one of the raised indices, I get a contribution like this, where I pull that index away and stick it on the Christoffel symbol. There's the derivative index. And then I fill that in with a contraction where I pulled it out. And I get another set of contributions that look like this for the covariant indices. And again, here's the derivative index. I've pulled out one of those labels, and I've contracted with the Christoffel symbol. And there is a minus sign here. And so you can use these rules and bootstrap up to this general rule. In particular, one of the nice tensors that we know about is the metric. And so another result
that hopefully we're familiar with now is that if I take the covariant derivative of the metric, that that's just equal to zero. And so there, I'm going to use this rule, and so there is an ordinary derivative piece, and there's a couple of connection pieces, but I have a definition. This is just defined in terms of derivatives of g mu nu. And so when you plug in the definition of the Christoffel symbol and look at all the contributions, it turns out that they just cancel out and we're left with zero. So this comes theta mu. But this has a nice property then, in that I said that this object is a tensor. So I can write then T mu alpha. But we know that I can trade covariant and contravariant indices just by contracting with the metric. And so I can build a new tensor with both of the indices lowered just by writing T mu alpha. But I might worry then that, well, what does that really mean? I mean, this is a very compact notation, but does, when I write that, am I going to have to carry around in my formulas expressions like this, which are very non-compact or are going to become cumbersome? But what this is saying is that there's no problem that I can pull this metric inside the derivative, and it doesn't cost me anything because the covariant derivative there is zero. And so I can write this as del mu but that's then this del mu of the covariant derivative of the object or the covector that I build by contracting or lowering the index with the metric in the usual way. And so this is just saying that because our metric is covariantly constant or this derivative vanishes, I'm free to raise and lower indices in expressions like this or more complicated expressions like that at will. As long as I'm working with the covariant derivative. And I apologize, I'm probably going too low, but it says that I can raise and lower indices at will inside the covariant derivatives. This derivative or this expression also, again, it came from thinking about the geodesic equation. And so it gave us a new way to think about the geodesic equation in that armed with the covariant derivative, the geodesic equation becomes just U alpha contracted with the covariant derivative of U beta equals zero. And in fact, we had a similar prescription or a similar equation for for our basis vectors. Because remember that when we were thinking about the equation for geodesic deviation, we had to come up with a rule on how the observer carries the basis vectors around. And the simplest prescription was, or the equation that we wrote was something like this. They actually had lowered indices, and that's why I put co in brackets there. I hadn't talked about it at the time, but what we were actually carrying around were the dual vectors, or the dual bases. And we had an equation that looked like equals zero. If we make the same substitution we did before, that this derivative is just the four velocity contracted with an ordinary derivative acting here, then this just becomes then u beta l beta acting on this set of basis vectors. And in fact, notice that we had the right sign here. That was just what we wanted to get this expression here. Are we happy with that expression? So this was the geodesic equation. This was the, it's a rule that we used on how the observer carries his basis vectors around with him as he travels along a geodesic. And it gives, or this motivates a discussion then of something called parallel transport. So if we go back to flat space, where we should have good intuition, in that case, the geodesics are just straight lines. And when our observers carry vectors around, they're just constant vectors. And so they're just pushing them around, and the vectors don't change in the intuitive way. And so if I'm starting at some point and the four velocity carries me to another point, if my basis vector or my vector was over here like that, then I just get the same vector when I've moved it forward along the geodesic. What this rule does, though, I mean, this is the intuitive picture, and there's trivial math here if I'm using the Cartesian coordinates. What this rule does, though, is it lets me do this propagation or carrying the vector around in polar coordinates just as easily or just as accurately as it does in Cartesian coordinates, because this has the extra information about the coordinate basis changing from one point to the next in my flat space here. So if we go to flat space for intuition, and this rule over here has the intuitive interpretation that the vectors, or the basis vectors, or that they're just being propagated forward and remaining parallel, or hence the title parallel transport. Now, that's a lot of words for something that seems obvious. So this is just to motivate this idea, but it's also, or the name, but it's also then something. The idea, this set of rules, is something that we're applying in curved space. And so we'd like to extend the idea of parallel transport to our curved space geometry. which is precisely that formula. And so this idea is extended to curved space. And in fact, arbitrary trajectories or paths with the tangent and so the rule is that this gives us, or that essentially equation gives us the rule of the mathematics on how to carry a vector along the curve in a constant way. So parallel transport means that we carry the vector around with the rule that, and I can have any vector here. So I'm just I've picked some path, some arbitrary path. There's a tangent vector t. There's some vector v here. And this is giving me a differential equation that tells me how I carry that vector forward. In a way that, if you like, it remains constant. I mean, the intuitive picture that one can have is this one here, that as far as an observer is concerned, moving along here, this vector is remaining constant as long as it's carried forward with this differential equation, or it satisfies that differential equation. Yeah?
Does that mean that in flat space, that differential rules is trivially satisfied?
Yes. In flat space, in Cartesian coordinates, it's going to be trivial. Well, I'll comment on that in just a second, because it's important. So let me just write the words down, and then I'll say, why are we doing all this? So the intuition and an intuitive picture is that that's a good intuitive guide as to how to interpret this, but it is really a general concept that I can have an arbitrary path, and so the path could become space-like at points or null. It doesn't have to be restricted to a timeline trajectory that I could interpret always as a physical observer's trajectory. But this gives us an intuitive picture of how to interpret what that, if you like, differential equation is telling us. But as Chris was saying, you know, this is all, why is he doing all this math again? I mean, this is all trivial in flat space. Isn't there a better idea I can use in curved space? And the answer is no. In flat space, we don't give it much thought. Because we can find vectors that satisfy a much stronger condition, namely that the covariant derivative. So here I'm asking four equations be satisfied, but it's simply true in flat space. In fact, we can, if you like, trivially satisfy that because we can find vectors
that satisfy this equation, which is in fact 16 different equations, and so this is a much stronger constraint. And in particular, we don't have to worry about the path. And so the point of generating that set of ideas or that discussion is that in a curve space, I can have some trajectory or some path that carries me, well, we'll call this trajectory A. So we're going to carry some vector parallel transported along this path, and I'll get what I call VA, just to say that that's the one parallel transported along A. But in general, if I pick another path, B here, I'll end up with a different vector, VB. And the fact that different paths give me different answers over here is a reflection of the fact that there's curvature in the space-time, or in this region of the space inside the path. So, what do I want to say? Well, it's important in curved space because if I parallel transport between 2 points, will depend on that choice, on the choice of path. And so the classic example that we can think about is carrying vectors around on the surface of the Earth or on the surface of a two-dimensional sphere. So here we have a globe. Here's the equator. Here's the North Pole. Let's imagine that we're starting at 0 degrees latitude, and I'll just define that to be 0 degrees longitude. And I have a vector that's pointing, a unit vector that's pointing east, I guess. If I parallel transport that along the equator, I'm just going to walk and hold my vector like that, and I'll end up at a point over here with the vector then still pointing east along the equator. On the other hand, I can parallel transport it I can get to the same point over here by first going up to the North Pole. If I'm heading north, what I'll do is I'll just have my vector pointing east, and I'm walking north, and I'll hold it fixed like that. And so I've got my vector pointing at right angles to the trajectory or to the path everywhere. And so this is most dramatic if I pick a point over here now, which is 90 degrees separated in longitude. So say this is 90 degrees, or this is a right angle. Now I'm going to parallel transport along that line of longitude. But here again, when I got to the North Pole, every direction is south, and it happens that this vector is pointing south along this line of longitude, which is the path that I'm going to follow. And so when I'm heading south, my vector points south everywhere. And so when I end up, so we'll call this A, this was my vector V, this was what I got when I parallel transported just along the equator, that was path A. If B carried me along these two lines of longitude, I ended up with a vector that's pointing south, where it sits at 90 degrees to the, well, these two vectors sit at 90 degrees to each other. But the reason then, or an explanation of that, is that this is a curved geometry, and this region that's enclosed by these paths, or this collection of paths, contains curvature. So, the globe, or a 2D, at least simple, if you've seen it before. Is everybody happy with that explanation, what I did there? Okay, Chris is yawning. It must have been obvious. And I'll just say that in the, it's not a problem you have to hand in, but you're encouraged to think about this for an infinitesimal path and see exactly what the relation is between this shift in the vector for an infinitesimal path and the curvature that's inside the path. But the comment to make is that what this reflects is the failure of our covariant derivatives to commute. Yeah?
Does this imply some sort of non conservation, that there's some quantity that we would expect in a flat space to be conserved that is not conserved in curve?
Probably, yeah.
Yes.
Pointing
cycle? No. Think about, so do like, do the sphere experiment, but.
I think, I don't know if you've. So let me put it to you this way. Are you familiar with the idea that conserved quantities are associated with symmetries?
Yes.
So flat space has tons of symmetries. Lots of things are conserved. If I go to a general curved space, I lose a lot of those symmetries. And so things aren't conserved in the same way. Aaron, did you have another
one? So is there a physical, like, I could imagine, like, so when I walk, like, straight, if I'm carrying, like, a big arrow sign, and I'm, like, walking along the surface of the Earth, I'll probably, like, I'll sort of, like, reflexively keep it pointed in the direction I'm walking. And I could imagine somebody else with, like, slightly different reflexes, whose arrow, like, goes in a different way than mine as they walk around. So is there sort of a more physical, like, is there some sort of physical way to, like, visualize this aerial carrying process? Like, if I wanted, suppose I wanted to do, like, a really objective experiment in real space to see what the curvature is. And, like, I didn't want it to involve any sort of human interaction at all. Like, is there a way I could build some sort of, you know, some sort of thing to carry, some sort of arrow that could be, you know, shot around the Earth, for example, and tell me whether there's curvature in the space around the Earth?
So the answer is undoubtedly yes. Precisely how depends on the interpretation of the question, I think.
For example, my intuition is that if I'm in a satellite orbiting around the Earth, I should be able to measure, like, the angular velocity of objects, or the angular momentum of objects. And so I can, how about this? Okay, so I have, like, a big arrow with a gyroscope inside it.
Okay.
And the arrow has some sort of mechanism. There's a free gyro, and then, so we assume this always keeps pointing in the same direction. And then there's, like, the gyro is floating. It's a, friction-free satellite, and it's floating inside this arrow. which monitors the position of the gyroscope.
Right.
So.
It's called the satellite gravity control.
Oh, right, yeah. Oh, so is that what, okay. So is the idea that if the space, if the Earth were in flat space, if I put that into orbit, the gyroscope would always be pointing the same direction as the arrow?
Yeah, what they're actually looking for is a little bit more subtle rotation. I mean, but basically, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And the idea is if I did the sort of same thing on a space with a curvature, like on the surface of a sphere, I would.
Well, the thing is, though, that we've gone away from. This is a Euclidean example. I didn't have time, really, as part of the parallel transport. I mean, the space I was talking about was just this 2D sphere. And so I cheated a little bit. The experiments you're talking about are talking about a space-time experiment now.
Right.
The curvature we're talking about isn't the fact that the surface of the Earth is curved, but
right.
that there's a gravitational field.
But you should be able to do an analogous experiment. If you lived in a universe with one space dimension and one time dimension, it seems like you should be able to do an analogous experiment.
For example, you could live in our space. Except the matter gets in the way. But let's talk about it. This result here, though, I wanted to say reflects the fact that covariant derivatives don't commute, and so there's an important formula that I'm not going to derive. But I'll try and give you an intuitive picture that, you know, each one of those terms involves a covariant derivative acting on a covariant derivative of a vector. And so what you have then is a covariant derivative acting on something like that. If I expand again and ask, well, how does that covariant derivative act there? There's going to be a contribution which is just del mu, del nu, minus del nu, del mu, like where the ordinary derivatives act on these terms. But ordinary derivatives commute, and so that term goes away. There's also going to be terms where this derivative acts over here, and I'll be stuck with things where there's a Christoffel symbol and there's a derivative of v. I don't have a good intuitive answer, but if you go through the algebra, what you find is that these terms all cancel out in this combination. And so what you're left with then is two sets of terms. There's one where the ordinary derivative here acts on this Christoffel symbol, but then there are also Christoffel symbol terms here that multiply this term, and so there's other stuff like this. And so these are the ingredients, though, that went into the Riemann curvature. The Riemann curvature had terms with derivatives of Christoffel and terms quadratic in Christoffel. And sure enough, this is a tensor. And so the expression at the end of the day is a tensor. And so the formula, which I'm not deriving for you, I'm just presenting to you, is that this is true. So if I take the covariant derivative, but I take it in the opposite order and subtract, rather than getting zero, as I would with ordinary derivatives in flat space, I end up with a curvature term. And that reflects this fact that I can't just carry the vector anywhere along any path and get the same answer. If you like, if we demanded, or if we said, let's find let's find solutions of this equation, which is an equation we could solve in flat space, then as a consistency condition, if this set of derivatives vanishes, then this commutator should also vanish. And so consistency would demand then that I have an expression like this. And so it reduces from a differential equation to an algebraic equation. And in general, I'm not going to be able to find a solution
to this equation if there's curvature in the space. And so that's why we need these ideas of parallel transport associated with a particular path when we're talking about curve space. But again, there's this intuition that what we think about in general relativity when we're thinking about experiments is observers who are following world lines. And so these are natural concepts to use in that context. Are there any questions?
When the formulas is zero, is the solution.
Okay, no solution other than a trivial solution. Fair enough.
Does it ever come up that you have like a curvature with a direction like, I don't know, I'm thinking in Euclidean of like a ridge where there's locally some line where there's local. I know it's not generic, so I was just curious if it's a situation that tends to ever come up.
So you can invent space-time where the curvature is such that, in fact, you know, there may be curvature, but, you know, it has a very special structure. And so this, you know, this asks then, is there, when some sense, it's asking, you know, there's a collection of matrices here, do they all have zero eigenvalue, add a zero eigenvalue with a common eigenvector? And so in very special cases, you might be able to do that. So there's a place to take a pause there if the people leaving for the bus want to go, and I'll erase the board and turn my eyes so I don't see who chose the seminar over me. Okay, so I'd like to go back to the physics for a moment, or for the rest of the lecture. And so I wanted to think about Einstein's equations in vacuum, or the absence of any matter. What we had decided or proposed, or what is the correct answer, is that the Ricci curvature vanish. But this is defined in terms of the Riemann curvature and contracting various indices. The Riemann curvature is defined in terms of derivatives of Christoffel symbols and multiplication or contractions of Christoffel symbols. The Christoffel symbol itself is defined in terms of derivatives of metrics. And so what you really have hidden there in that nice compact equation or set of equations is some complicated or horrible, in the view of some nonlinear second order partial differential equations. So in general, that's really hard to solve.
And that's why it's useful to have a tool like Mathematica or Maple, as I guess this select subgroup will find out this afternoon, to solve those equations. What I hope we learned yesterday is that the Schwarzschild metric is a solution of that equation there. But that's a far cry from actually solving the equation from scratch. And so the only comment I wanted to make there is that typically what we do is we think about situations that have extra symmetries, and those symmetries then can be used to constrain what goes in the metric, and it also simplifies then these equations. So we impose and so in the case of Schwarzschild, the symmetries that we might impose are spherical symmetry or the fact that things are time independent if we're talking about a static source. And so imposing those two symmetries is we're going to impose very strict constraints on the form of the metric. And so it makes this a tractable problem. If I didn't know the Schwarzschild solution, you could go through a certain set of steps and find that, in fact, that is an interesting solution. And I'll just say there's some discussion of that particular example. And you're encouraged to think about it some more in the homework assignment. But I wanted to turn to another situation where it's easy to deal with these equations. And so the situation that we're thinking about, again, is Einstein's equations in the absence of matter. But weak field means that we want to think that the space-time is essentially flat space-time with small deviations. So what I mean is that my g alpha beta is equal to the flat space metric plus h alpha beta, and these we'll call the metric perturbations. And here I really mean that I'm working in Cartesian coordinates. And so this is just a diagonal matrix with minus 1, 1, 1, 1. And what I want is that these things are small fluctuations or small deviations. And so each one of the entries here, since this is all zeros and ones, each one of the entries here, what I want is that they're much less, the value is much less than 1. So we're perturbing, this is what perturbation means, or perturbing around flat space. We're working in that particular limit. And in particular, then, that means that in dealing with the equations, we're only going to work to linear order in H. So in general, those equations have many, many powers of the metric and would generate many, many powers of H. But we're only going to work perturbatively to linear order. So what do Einstein's equations look like? Yeah.
3D symmetry.
Sorry, say that again?
Is the asymmetric, right, and then it's 3D symmetry because G alpha beta is symmetric.
Oh, yes, I know. You're saying H alpha beta has to be equal to H theta alpha. Yeah. Sure. So there's only 10 independent numbers that I'm sticking in there, and they're all small. So here, this was, this was the equation. What does this reduce to? And the shortcut that I want to propose is recall the nice formula that we had in the inertial frame. We had a formula, oh dear, lots of indices. So nu alpha mu beta nu alpha nu beta mu alpha nu beta. So we went to a very special coordinate system at a given point, and we hopefully one of the exercises was that we derived this formula, which is fairly compact. But the claim is I can just use that formula to write out what the curvatures are going to be in this particular problem. And so the claim is that I just take the same formula, and I stick an H everywhere I had a G. And so I better stick the indices in. And so that's a claim. And at this point, I turn to the audience and ask, why would that preposterous claim possibly be the correct answer? Yes?
Because sigma alpha beta is not dependent on the coordinates on time. So it's a constant measure.
So one of the comments is that this is constant. And so if I just substitute this g alpha beta in here, I'm going to get that answer. But then remember, this is in an inertial frame, so it was in a special coordinate system, and it only applied at a given point. So that's close, but it's not enough. You see the distinction? So if I move away from that point, then in principle, I'm going to get other stuff. But the point is that the other stuff is all stuff that's quadratic or higher order in the H. And so the reason that I get away with this is for the observation you made, this just doesn't contribute. This is flat space. The curvature vanishes or the derivatives all vanish everywhere. But I shouldn't write this as r. I'll write it as delta r to emphasize that this is the result, this is the correct answer working in linear order. Which is what I define the problem to be. But it's straightforward then, given that nice formula. There are only four terms here, and I know that I'm supposed to make some kind of a contraction.
Well, maybe I'm supposed to say, okay. So the terms we discarded are all higher order in H. So that's just, well, an excuse for using that formula. What I want is to know what this is. Again, this means to linear order in H. But then all I have to do is make a contraction, mu alpha of our delta r, mu nu alpha beta. And again, what I'm doing is I'm contracting with the flat space, or the inverse of the flat space metric. In general, our curve space inverse G alpha beta is equal to that inverse, and it turns out the answer is minus H alpha beta plus order H squared. But the point is that none of this stuff is going to contribute in this equation if I'm restricting myself to linear order, because everything here is already linear. And so anytime an H appears here, it's a higher order contribution. So that's why I get away with just using the flat space metric to do the contraction to find the Ricci tensor to linear order. But let's just do the contraction. I want to contract on the mu index and the alpha index. And so there's a 1/2. The first term that I'm going to pick out is this term, because that's really nice. It contracts just the derivative indices, and I get what I'll call box or D'Alembertian acting on H nu beta. And then what am I doing? I'm contracting mu and alpha. So if I contract mu and alpha here, I get a derivative and then the divergence. So there's a plus del nu I contract again on mu and alpha, but I remember now that these indices are symmetric. Ordinary derivatives, I can commute them. And so what I can do is I can push this into the same form as that expression. There's a del beta flip the indices here and flip the indices here just so that it has the same form with a divergence of H. And the only difference is that the two indices there are in the opposite order. And then I have to do this term where I'm just taking the trace on the two indices on the H, and I get the two derivatives. So there's a minus del nu del beta H alpha alpha. And then what Hartle does is he rearranges that equation in a nice, or in a particularly nice way. He says, well, this is nu beta. So we like this term. This looks like it's going to give us a wave equation. But then he says that I can combine these two terms, or those three terms, in a compact way by writing it as del nu v beta plus del beta v nu, where he's defined some new vector, which is just first this contribution, so the divergence. And then what he's done is he's taken this term and shared it between the two contributions, the derivatives of V, and so there's an extra bit here that he had, del beta of H, the trace of H. So I've reduced, or I've combined those three terms into that expression there. Yep. No, sorry. You're asking me if the entries of H are differentiable functions? By assumption, they're going to be, yes. Sorry, I missed a negative sign somewhere. This negative sign? No, that, I encourage you to check that. This is the, I started with talking about G alpha beta, the metric. Here I'm writing the inverse metric. It turns out that this is a minus sign there, where this means that I've raised the indices just with the eta alpha beta. And in fact, though, the inverse metric doesn't stop there. To make it actually act like the inverse, in principle, there'd be a whole expansion to arbitrary orders in the H's.
That's one here, minus thing. So that's where the minus sign. Does that make sense?
No. Go ahead. That's one way to think of it. So if Callum has an intuition that that's where you find the minus sign. Alternatively, just take the metric. What I want is that G alpha beta, G beta mu, is just delta alpha mu. So if you take
this equation, alternatively, I can write that as eta plus h, and then ask what do I get here, or what do I have to put here in the inverse metric to satisfy this equation. Let us carry on. So this is, or this equals zero, is going to be our Einstein equation to linear order in this weak field gravity. One of the things that we can note is that I've been talking about weak fields. I've said that the entries in the metric are all, you know, the standard plus and minus ones, plus small perturbations, plus small numbers. But I've said nothing about dealing with slow velocities, which is an extra constraint that I imposed when we were originally talking about making the transition from Newtonian gravity to curved space-time. So note that here we have no mention of and so a question we might ask is, how do we fix up our metric, our transition metric that we wrote as ds squared equals minus 1 plus 2 phi of x t squared plus dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. So remember, this is a metric that we used, again, in our, when we were first introducing, where we were first introducing the ideas of curved space-time, and this was the contribution that told us about clocks running at different rates when they were put at different places in the gravitational field. But I kept emphasizing that we also had higher order contributions here in principle, but that as long as we were working with slow velocities, we didn't have to worry about them. Yeah.
So we're doing this to linear order.
Right.
And you find that this linear order is equal to zero.
Yes.
And then you assume that the linear order was much larger than the second order, even though the second order is positive. So what happened? The second order is a bunch of h squared, which are all positive. So
I think what you might be saying is, in principle, if I write down a solution, I'd better go back and check that I'm consistently solving it so that the h's are all small.
Well, I feel like you're saying that h squared is less than zero, because you're saying that h squared is less than that, but you're setting this to be zero, so I'm confused as to what you just did.
I'll listen to Nima's comment, but I understand what the question is.
Yeah, there is no reason for the quadratic term for h to be positive. Because they're not h squared, they're h alpha beta, h beta gamma.
But I think what you're saying is, so I would have to work harder. You would do it as you would do any. I don't know if you. Have you done various perturbation expansions in quantum mechanics?
Possibly a long time ago.
So what I did is I wrote down G nu equals G nu plus H nu. And then I said I'm going to work the linear order. So let's say more properly, if I wanted to do this a better job, what I would do is I'd say that there's actually some expansion parameter. And so what I would do is I would say that this is approximately equal to this, and I put an extra subscript or a superscript there. And then what I would say is that delta r mu nu as a function of h1 is equal to 0. And I would solve for h1. It's a simple, we haven't got to that yet.
When you do this next step over here with the 5, you're going to get the second derivative of 5 equal to 0. Because say you just take the first derivative and square it.
But this was an expansion parameter, and so all I've done is I've solved the first order in the expansion. In principle, there's another term here, or I could work harder and incorporate second order terms. And what I would find at this order, so this is order epsilon to the 1, at order epsilon to the 2, what I would find, it turns out, is that the terms linear in H2 are going to have exactly the same form. Does that make sense? Okay, but then what we're saying is at this order, there's also junk stuff involving h1 squared. And so what I would say is I'd have this equation equals stuff involving h1 squared. I have the solution here for h1. And so what that does is this provides or makes a source term for this new wave equation. And so given that, I would solve. So here I solve for h1. That makes a source term. But then I can solve that wave equation for h2. And if I, if I want to work hard, I can go to the next order. In principle, I can work to any order that I want. And that way, I think I'm consistently taking care of what you want. So I'm being a little bit glib and just saying in the discussion up to this point. Joe.
So when you were talking about weak fields, like is the way to think about this that you're just looking for solutions of the PDEs that happen to be close to ADA rather than having to do with like some matter sources or something? Because we haven't really talked about that.
Right. We're going to introduce matter tomorrow. And so we're still working with the vacuum equation.
Okay.
And if I get to say it today, one of the cool things is, you know, I have this Dalembertian sitting there, and so principles are waves that we didn't know about before. So in the absence of any matter, I can have ripples propagating through my space-time geometry.
So what, like, sources is the ripples?
Sorry?
So, like, what source is the ripples?
Merging black hole winery. This source is the ripple. This is a source of space. Here's an energy matter.
There's no matter.
No, there is matter. Look, my hand, that's matter. It's mass, it's energy. It's also got momentum, it's moving around. In principle, it's sourcing gravitational waves.
Right. There's no matter on the right hand side.
So that's a whole other discussion. How do you actually generate these gravitational waves?
Okay.
But in the same way that when I study Maxwell's equations, the first thing I do is I write down the plane wave solutions, which we may not get to before your bus leaves, but.
Right. Okay, so you can write down the solutions without worrying about it.
Yeah. But I wanted to do an exercise first. So we have written down this. For phi small and v squared small, where I set c equal to 1. So how am I going to fix that up if I don't want this to be true, which is certainly the context in which we're talking about here. Here we're just talking about small fields or small entries. And Hartle actually suggested the answer. Hartle suggested that there's an extra factor here, or there's an extra contribution here coming from, with an entry that also contains the Newtonian potential. And he has a specific contribution in mind there, but I'm just going to stick in 1 plus A, some arbitrary constant, times the Newtonian potential, and we're going to stick that in here as a prefactor for our flat space, or our flat spatial direction. And so we're going to use this equation then to ask, what is that constant A? So the first thing we should do is figure out, what is our H alpha beta if I write down the metric like this. So there's an HTT, which is equal to minus 2 times the Newtonian potential. That's just this contribution here. There aren't any off-diagonal terms, so HTI, say, where I is x, y, or z, those are all equal to 0. And HIJ is equal to A times the Newtonian potential. When we're on the diagonal. And so I can write that compactly as saying there's a Kronecker delta ij. So the off-diagonal components, again, are 0, but along the diagonal, I get A phi, A phi, A phi. So the Newtonian potential satisfies that, del squared phi equals 0. And so that means then, phi is independent of t. That means that this part of the equation is trivially satisfied because this is just the usual
minus dt squared plus dx squared acting on this. And so the dt squared doesn't do anything because there's no time dependence in phi or in the h's. The del squared is what's left over then when I throw away the dt squared. And so mox h alpha beta is equal to 0. And so that's trivially satisfied, or physics fixed that to be 0, i.e. there's physics here in that equation. And so what we have to worry about is making sure that these two terms actually vanish. So one way to achieve that, or a simple way which we'll be able to realize to achieve these two terms being equal to 0, is actually to set the vector here equal to 0. So well, what goes into that? One of the things I need to know is what's the trace of h. That's just h alpha beta, or 8 alpha beta contracted with h alpha beta with downstairs indices. Here we have the various contributions. And so what I'm going to get is a bunch of terms that are all they're all proportional to phi. There's a minus 1 in the TT contribution that's going to cancel that minus 1. And so there's a 2 here. And then there are three terms along the diagonal, x, y, and z. And they're each giving me a factor of a. And so there's a 3 times a. So I'm just writing that out because that's one of the ingredients that goes into constructing v. Okay. So let's look at this term by term. Let's look at the first term when that index is t. Here I'm looking at a time derivative of this trace, but there's nothing depending on time there, so that vanishes automatically. Similarly here, I've got a t index, but the only term is htt, and so again, I'm looking at a time derivative. But again, nothing depends on time, and so this term vanishes. So that's because I have a diagonal h and phi, well, phi is independent of t. Phi is phi of x. So then we've got vx. What happens when I stick an x in there? Again, this is diagonal, and so I'm going to get an x derivative acting on hxx. And I'm going to have an x derivative acting on the trace. And so there are two contributions, del x, hxx. And implicitly, I'm using the fact that eta alpha or eta xx is just equal to 1. And then there's a minus del x of h alpha alpha. So again, if I hadn't erased it, we would see that hxx is a times phi. And so, in fact, all of these terms give me an x derivative. Sorry?
Rather than minus.
There should be a minus a half. Correct. So the first term is giving us an a, and
and then there's our minus a half, and the prefactor there was a 2 plus 3 halves a. And so this is del x phi. I've got a minus 3 halves, so there's a minus a by 2, and then there's a minus 1. Similarly, I can look at y, and I get vy. The only thing that changes, and it's, well, the same for z. And so those last three equations are the same, and so the way I can satisfy that the vector vanishes is by setting that coefficient to be equal to 0. And so to do that, I would choose a equals minus 2. And so the metric, after we fixed it up, then agrees with Hartle's result. So this satisfies our weak field equations. Our linearized Einstein equations. And another point is that, in fact, this agrees, well, it agrees with Hartle, but it also agrees with Schwarzschild, or the expansion of the Schwarzschild metric, which may seem like a surprising claim, because it is, until I add the caveat that I'm using in isotropic coordinates. So this isn't a coordinate system that we really talked about in class, but in the exercise sheets, I introduced a coordinate system where, rather than separating the dr squared from the r squared and angular stuff, you could put them all together in what, well, this isotropic form, so that it looked like dx squared, dy squared, dz squared. And so when you make that coordinate choice and you expand in m over r, the first two terms, in fact, precisely agree with the contributions that we get here. But what that points to is the idea, what happened to the idea of coordinate choices. In particular, when we talked about the Schwarzschild metric and we went inside the horizon, we had all sorts of interesting different ways to represent the same geometry. But it was just labeling that same space-time geometry. It wasn't changing it. It was just giving it new labels. And so what kind of coordinate choices can we make when we're working in this linearized framework? So in this linearized framework, I don't want to do something radical like going to, well, I don't even want to go to polar coordinates. I want to stay close to Cartesian coordinates. But I don't want to do something as radical as we did in our Schwarzschild case. And so we'd better consider, if you like, small changes in the coordinates or small shifts in the changes. And so to avoid using hats, I write a y as my new coordinate. And what I want is that the old x's and my new y's are pretty close, but I can stick in some arbitrary function here. But there's a sense in which I think of this as a small shift. And we can make that precise in a moment. But the idea, again, is just like the perturbation in the metric or the H field, we only work to linear order. Similarly, I'm only going to work to linear order here. And so, in fact, it's most convenient to turn this around and write this as x being a function of y minus epsilon alpha. And I've set the argument now equal to y. That's not quite correct because y and x differ by an epsilon term. And so there are higher order terms. But again, because I'm only working to linear order, I can just stop there. Or I'll only keep track of that particular contribution. Then the rule, well, we have this beautiful coordinate transformation rule. But the rule in the class is that you never use that. What we do is we look at the line element. So the line element was ds squared equals 8 alpha beta plus h alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to stick this coordinate transformation in there. And I'm only going to work, or I'm only going to keep terms that are linear in h and linear in epsilon. And so what I get then is, well, the obvious term, well, the obvious thing to do is I just stick that. And this becomes dy alpha plus d mu epsilon alpha dy mu times dy beta plus d nu epsilon beta dy nu. And so I just expand everything out and keep only the terms linear. So I have my standard term. And then the new contributions I can write as and then there's a dy alpha dy beta. So there are two contributions with derivatives of this small shift in the coordinates. But again, because I'm working linearly, I only keep the leading contributions here. And we can use that equation to define more precisely what I meant by small, in that what I want is that these contributions here, just like the h's, are much less than 1. Each one of those entries is much less than 1. But if I look at that, I can see that, well, I can write that in terms of our linearized ansatz, but in the new coordinate system. And our new metric perturbation, then, is just the old one plus this shift that came from the coordinate transformation. So that's y coordinates. And that was in our x. And we're almost there. So one comment here, just in passing, I won't write it on the board, is that what this is saying is that there's a freedom in the choice of coordinates when I'm doing my linearized gravity. And I can do the same physics with different choices of h, but those h's are all going to be related in a very special way. And that's similar to the idea that we might have seen in electromagnetism when we describe it in terms of a vector potential and an electrostatic potential. What you find when you're doing electromagnetism is that there are many different choices you can make that are always going to give you the same electric field and magnetic field. And so there's an ambiguity in electromagnetism that goes there by the name of a gauge ambiguity, or you call the transformation or the shifts between different choices a gauge transformation. And so we inherit the same set of words here, calling them gauge transformations. And they're standing at the back there discussing whether or not they should cut me off. And they've got to grab the chalk out of my hand because I've got this interesting stuff to say. Do you have to go? Or two more? Oh. Okay, so I guess we'll finish this tomorrow. Okay.